against humanity of apartheid and persecution against Palestinians. So how did we reach that determination? Let me get into the bulk of my presentation. I want to walk through those three elements I laid out and the ways in which we reached that particular determination. So let me walk through them one by one, and then I'll step back and conclude my remarks. So the first one, let's start with the intent to dominate. Based on our research, Human Rights Watch concluded that Israeli authorities have pursued an intent or a policy to maintain the domination by Jewish Israelis over Palestinians across Israel and Palestine. Now, our research shows that this largely manifests through the desire to control land and demographics for the benefit of Jewish Israelis and to the detriment of Palestinians. Or to put it much more simply, the Israeli government has applied and followed the maxim of maximum land, minimum Palestinians. So let me say a word about demographics. I think ultimately, understanding this is the key to understanding modern Israeli policy. So to give you one example, the Israeli government since 2003 has prohibited the granting of long-term legal status to Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza who are married to Israeli citizens or nationals or residents. Much more simply, Israelis can marry people from basically anywhere in the world and give them legal status to live with them in Israel, but not Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza. Now, our research, we looked at the debate in the Knesset at the time. We reviewed statements by Israeli government officials from all political parties, and all of them are quite explicit, even in their statement, that this was done to maintain Jewish demographic majority. That's why that prohibition exists. It's not unique to that. There are many other examples. Let me give the most, maybe the most egregious or the most clear-cut example. Today, a Jewish American who's never been to Israel can get on a plane. Maybe they live in Denver. They can get on a plane tomorrow, go to Israel. They can live there and become a citizen automatically, while a Palestinian who's been languishing for 75 years in a refugee camp with a key to their home with generations there cannot do so because they're Palestinian, not Jewish. This is clearly done by Israeli government admission for demographic reasons. Now, the second part to this, besides demographics, is land. So our research shows that Israeli policy has sought to maximize the land available to Jewish Israelis and confine Palestinians into dense enclaves. Again, let me give you some examples. There is a formal Israeli government policy, and I put this in quotes, to Judaize the Negev and the Galilee. These are regions that make up two-thirds the land in Israel proper. In fact, if you read the Israeli newspaper today, you're going to find out that one government ministry is holding up the discussions on a new Israeli budget because there's not enough money to Judaize the Negev and the Galilee. This isn't just words on paper. There are laws based on it. Let me give you one example. Do folks in this room know that Israeli law authorizes different cities and towns to have admissions committees to decide who to live there and can decide to deny Palestinians living there? And in fact, a professor at an Israeli university found that there are 900 small Jewish towns and communities that have zero Palestinians living there. It's not just in the Negev and the Galilee. In Jerusalem, which encompasses occupied East Jerusalem, the municipality, as Israel drew the lines, and West Jerusalem, in the government policy documents, which we quote in our report, it lays out its objective, the objective of the municipality, which is to maintain, quote, a solid Jewish majority in the city. The plan even identifies target demographic ratios that they hope to maintain between Jewish Israelis and between Palestinians. And the same policy is in place in the West Bank. We quote from the Drobel's plans of the West Bank in the report, which literally lays out in plain letter terms that the government policy in this particular area is and I quote, to make it hard for Palestinians to create territorial continuity and political unity and remove any trace of doubt about our intent to control Judea and Samaria forever. This is a quote from a government, basically a government plan. And again, it's not just words on paper. They're backed up by years, decades of government policy to expand settlements and the infrastructure connecting it to Israel proper. Even in Gaza, you have 2.1 million Palestinians living in a 25-by-7-mile strip of land. Israel in 2005 removed its settler population and actually removed ground troops. They still maintained control in other ways. But our research of nearly two decades, 18 years of Israeli government policy, shows that basically what the Israeli government sought to do was to gerrymander, right? To basically turn Gaza into a receptacle for holding Palestinians that are off the demographic books in Israel and the West Bank, which Israel hopes to retain long term. And we show how we reach this conclusion based on who is allowed to move where. And you can see the report for more details. People are generally not allowed to move anywhere, but where they are, they can move from the West Bank to Gaza, but not the other way around. Done for demographic reasons. Last point I'll make on the intent to dominate. The Israeli government, of course, does face legitimate security considerations, right? But it's important to note that the abuses at the heart of apartheid, whether it's denying building permits to Palestinians, but giving it to settlers living in Israeli settlements, whether it's the 2003 law I mentioned, you know, whether it's the land expropriation, has not even offered security justification. And even where security is a consideration, take, for example, the Gaza policy I mentioned, where there is concerns around the presence of Hamas and Palestinian armed groups, the Israeli government policy goes so beyond what international law authorizes that it no more justifies apartheid and persecution than it would justify torture, to say we did it for security reasons or other grave crimes. Okay, so we finished the intent to dominate. That's how we reached that conclusion. Again, I'm summarizing dozens of pages of research in, you know, a few minutes. Part two. So we have an intent to dominate. Do we have systematic oppression? I'm working my way backwards from the way I laid out the element. We reached the conclusion, yes, there is systematic oppression of Palestinians. So let me walk through the different domains of Israeli control. Let's start with the West Bank. In the West Bank, I'm excluding East Jerusalem, which is part of the West Bank for a second, you have 2.7 million Palestinians living among, let's say, between 400,000 and 500,000 Jewish Israeli settlers. They are governed under different bodies of law. They might live across the street, but different bodies of law. So a Jewish Israeli is governed under Israeli civil law. A Palestinian is governed under draconian military law. What does that mean? If a Jewish Israeli and a Palestinian who could live across the street commit the very same criminal act, they're tried in different courts, they receive different due process, or if I want to be more specific, one receives due process, Jewish Israeli, the Palestinian does not, and they receive different sentences for the very same act. It's not just about dual legal regimes. On top of that, you have a situation in which Israel enforces segregation. Settlements which are built on Palestinian land that's been stolen. I'll get to that in a minute. Palestinians cannot even enter settlements except if they're a laborer that has a special permit that allows them in. Not only that, the Israeli government not only has usurped the land and resources of the West Bank, but when it controls both populations, but when it gives that land back, land and resources to civilians, the vast majority goes to Jewish Israelis living in settlements. Let me note parenthetically, settlements are a war crime because the Fourth Geneva Convention prohibits the acquisition of territory by force. Hello, Ukraine, Russia, right? But yet, the Israeli government is using those settlements and actually giving government data, Israeli government data, 99% of the land given for civilian use in the West Bank has gone to settlements, not to Palestinians who are from there. What about East Jerusalem? One domain is West Bank. Many of the same dynamics apply. So for example, let's say a Jewish Israeli and a Palestinian come to study here in Denver for university, right? They spend 4 years. The Jewish Israeli can go back to Jerusalem, maintain their same status as a citizen, their same residency, their same rights. A Palestinian, who by the way is largely, most Palestinian Jerusalemites are stateless. They are given the status of resident, right? Even though this is the place that they're from for generations, could lose their right to live in their native city solely because they were abroad for too long. The Israeli government applies a different policy to Palestinians versus Jewish Israelis when it comes to legal residency status. There are many other examples. Let's move to Gaza, right? The third domain of Israeli control. In Gaza, which I just told you about the policy, for 16 years, the Israeli government has imposed a generalized ban on the movement of people or goods. It's a closure policy. Nobody in, nobody out, unless you fall within a narrow band of humanitarian exemptions. So most of the population of Gaza has never left the 25-by-7-mile Gaza Strip. This is not some abstract principle. I manage a colleague for Human Rights Watch who lives in Gaza, who never left that Gaza until she was 31. And we did it because we pulled all sorts of cards and connections to get her out for a short visit before she went back. Now, again, this is not a security policy. It's a blanket ban on everybody, right? So somebody, for example, could be allowed out one day. My colleague, you know, might be allowed out one day because she fits within a humanitarian exemption, right? Let's say somebody needs a life-saving surgery and Israelis grant them a permit. But the next week, if they want to travel to study somewhere or for vacation, God forbid, they could be denied, not because they're a security threat, but because of some arbitrary policy. It's not just, by the way, about people, also the movement of goods. Most people don't realize that most exports are not allowed out of Gaza. Even most fruits and vegetables. Or they allow one fruit, but not one other fruit. Again, it's not because one fruit is more dangerous than the other. It's because it is a blanket policy that's largely meant to affect the civilian population. And it affects Gaza's economy. 80% of Gaza's population relies on humanitarian aid. The majority of families spend the majority of their day without active electricity, whereas Jewish Israelis living kilometers away have 24/7 electricity. Gaza has been an active case of de-development. Its GDP per capita has gone down since early 1990s. By the way, this is not some backwater. Gaza is like a very sophisticated, high-rise buildings, well-educated population that's being deprived of their basic rights. And fourth and final domain is Israel proper, where although Palestinians inside Israel are technically citizens of Israel that vote in elections, they're not nationals of Israel. So what that means is, in 2018, Israel passed the Jewish nation state law, which says that Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people. And that law reserves certain rights only for Jews, including the right to self-determination, right? Or settlement, land being just. And there are many examples. The most dramatic example being in the Nakab or the Negev region of Israel, where there are 90,000 Palestinian Bedouin who are living in communities that are not recognized by the Israeli government. They are subject to home demolitions. They don't receive basic services. They're not connected to the electricity and water grids. Doesn't happen for Jewish Israeli communities living in Israel proper. What does all this add up together? Systematic oppression. So we reach the conclusion that we have systematic oppression. So we've just listed two of the three elements. So what's the final one? Have there been inhuman or inhumane acts carried out against Palestinians? Unfortunately, we reach the conclusion that yes, there have been. Our report focuses on five clusters of inhumane acts. These are not an exhaustive list. This is what Amnesty International, other groups have found different ones, but this is what we found. Let me just briefly mention them. We've covered some of them. One, the movement restrictions. I mentioned the closure of Gaza. Even in the West Bank, though, Palestinians require a very difficult to obtain permit to enter large parts of the West Bank. So again, using the analogy of this room, probably virtually everybody in this room, myself excluded because I was deported by the Israeli government, could get on a plane today and go to Israel, can go to East Jerusalem, can go to the old city of East Jerusalem. Palestinians who have lived their entire lives in the West Bank cannot go sometimes 3 kilometers to East Jerusalem without a very difficult to obtain permit from the Israeli army. Again, Jewish Israelis don't need permits. Beyond that, the Israeli government has built nearly 600 checkpoints and other closure obstacles spread around the West Bank that can turn a routine commute to school, to work, into an hours-long humiliating ordeal. On top of that, the Israeli government has built a separation barrier, largely on Palestinian land in the West Bank, which separates thousands of Palestinians from their farmlands, from hospitals, from schools, from their larger communities. Put it all together, Gaza closure, all the things I just said about the West Bank, we found this constitutes an inhumane act of sweeping restrictions without justification on the freedom of movement. Second inhumane act that we documented is land expropriation. Again, I mentioned this in brief, but more than 2 million dunams of land, more than one-third of the West Bank, has been taken from Palestinians using a variety of different legal tools. Our report goes into excruciating detail about each legal mechanism to explain the ways in which the Israeli government has stolen land from Palestinians to give it to settlements. It is also worth noting that this system of land expropriation has reduced Palestinians to living in what the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem describes 165 non-contiguous territorial islands. This is a result of the mass expropriation of Palestinian land. Again, this is turning Palestinians in their own territory out of their land. Inhumane act, mass land expropriation. Third, our report talks about the policies that make it effectively impossible for Palestinians to build homes in the majority of the West Bank that's under Israel's exclusive control, which is known as Area C, plus in East Jerusalem. According to Israeli government data, the Israeli government issued between 2016 and 2018 100 times more demolition orders than building permits for Palestinians living in the majority of the West Bank under Israel's exclusive control. As a result, every year the Israeli government demolishes hundreds of Palestinian homes, schools, and businesses for no other reason than they lack an impossible-to-get permit, which is not allowed under international law, which only allows demolitions in occupied territory for imperative reasons of security. Meanwhile, the illegal settlements continue to expand every day, every week, every month, every year. This policy amounts to forcible transfer, Human Rights Watch and others have found, and is an inhumane act, one of those set out under the legal instruments. Final two inhumane acts, and I'll move towards wrapping up. Fourth, our report talks about the denial of residency and nationality rights to Palestinians. I gave you the example of East Jerusalem a second ago, but even in the West Bank and Gaza, more than 500,000 Palestinians have lost their ability to live in their homes in the occupied territory because they were abroad for too long between 1967 and the mid-1990s, or because they weren't there when the occupation began in 1967. Plus, in Jerusalem, nearly 15,000 suffered the fate I mentioned. The Israeli government found they did not maintain sufficient connection or center of life in Jerusalem and revoked their residency rights in their native city. And fifth and finally, the report talks about the mass suspension of civil rights for the 4.7, nearly 5 million Palestinians in the West Bank or Gaza. This gathering, if we were to have this exact gathering in Bethlehem, Ramallah, or in Nablus, would be unlawful because you need a permit from the Israeli army for Palestinians as more than 10 people to gather. If you don't have that permit, people can be jailed for 10 years. So this is not some new law. 55 years, 56 years in June, this has been the law. Also around free assembly, Israel recently outlawed six prominent Palestinian human rights organizations, some of whom partner with Human Rights Watch, freedom of expression, people jailed for mere opposition to Israeli rule. So inhumane acts, systematic oppression, intent to dominate. Let me, as I move towards wrapping up, just say a few things, right? This is the most stark assessment Human Rights Watch has ever reached on the conduct of Israeli authorities. But it's not the only place where we've reached this kind of determination. Human Rights Watch found that the treatment of the Rohingya in Myanmar constitutes apartheid and persecution. We found that the treatment of the Uyghurs in China amounts to crimes against humanity, including persecution. Our recommendations in the report are consistent with where we've made these kind of findings the place. Again, I found crimes against humanity myself in Egypt, in the killings of protesters, colleagues. We found even that the PA and Hamas arbitrary arrest of distance and torture may amount to crimes against humanity. So our recommendations in the report are very similar to where we reached those conclusions elsewhere. Basically, hold perpetrators to account and ensure no complicity in these crimes. So I'll just give you six specific key recommendations from the report. One is to recognize the reality of apartheid, for states to issue statements recognizing it's the reality for millions of Palestinians. Secondly, we call for the UN to take action. We call for the UN to establish a special envoy for the crimes of apartheid persecution universally. We call on the International Criminal Court to investigate and prosecute those Israeli officials implicated in the crime, as well as for courts around the world to do so under the principle of universal jurisdiction. We call for targeted sanctions, including asset freezes and travel bans, against those Israeli officials implicated in these crimes. And we call for the U.S. And other states, so long as apartheid persists, to suspend military and security assistance to the Israeli government. And we call for all businesses, all other actors, all states to evaluate all forms of engagement with Israel to mitigate human rights impact and to end those activities where it cannot ensure it's not complicit in apartheid and persecution. So these asks boil down to the following few points, which is where I'll move towards ending my remarks. First, a 55-year occupation, now 56-year occupation, is not temporary. Denying millions of Palestinians their fundamental rights solely because of who they are, solely because they were born Palestinian and not Jewish, is not simply a matter of an abusive occupation. A 30-plus year stalled peace process alone will not dismantle systematic repression. Democracy is, and I'm quoting now my friend Haggai Al-Ad, he's the executive director of Beth Salem. He wrote once that democracy is, quote, the rule of the people, not the rule of one people over another. A daily reality of structural violence and repression, a single system methodically engineered to privilege one people at the expense of another, is not a conflict between two equal parties. The first step to solving a problem is to diagnose it correctly, right? The wrong diagnosis leads to the wrong recommendations, the wrong way forward. Apartheid is not some hypothetical future solution. It might not even have been a hypothetical future solution in the mid-1970s, when then Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin warned about the prospect of apartheid. It may not even have been a hypothetical in 2006, when Jimmy Carter, U.S. president, wrote a book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. It may not even have been a hypothetical in 2014, when then Secretary of State John Kerry warned that apartheid was just around the corner. Apartheid is the lived reality for Palestinians. Don't just take my word for it. Don't just take Human Rights Watch's word. This is the consensus in the human rights movement. Amnesty International reached the same conclusion. The Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem, not only B'Tselem, in December of this year, 27 Israeli human rights groups used the term apartheid to describe the treatment of Palestinians. So did the Harvard Law School, International Human Rights Clinic. So did several major UN experts. So did Palestinian civil society has been saying this for years and nobody listened. But forget human rights groups. Even beyond human rights groups, more and more officials are saying the same thing. The former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, Lawrence Tribe, the professor at Harvard, prominent commentators, including at MSNBC, and even in Israel, the two former Israeli ambassadors to South Africa, one of whom was the former director general of Israel's foreign ministry, the former attorney general and deputy attorney general, current members of the Israeli Knesset, 120 Israeli law professors, the most prominent ones in a statement issued a couple of months ago, all of whom have used the term apartheid. And now governments are doing the same, including South Africa and Namibia themselves, who every time they speak about Israel-Palestine at the UN, virtually every time, use the term apartheid. So as the entire African bloc, the entire Arab bloc, and the entire Organization of Islamic Conference at the UN. So as the former foreign minister of France and the current foreign minister of Luxembourg referenced apartheid in relation to human. I could go on for another 30 minutes listing people. The point of my remarks is the U.S. conversation is out of touch with the reality on the ground. We are at a moment of unprecedented challenge and repression. It's a very difficult time. We just emerged from another round of hostilities in Israel-Palestine. Many of us want a better peace, a better future for Israelis and Palestinians. But whatever solution, whatever path you believe we should take, the first step is to recognize reality for what it is and bring to bear the sorts of tools necessary to end it. Thank you for your time.
You were just listening to Uma Shaker on Israel-Palestine, A Threshold Crossed. He spoke in May at the University of Denver. Uma Shaker is the Israel-Palestine Director of Human Rights Watch. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 37th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Medea Benjamin, Noam Chomsky, Ilan Pape, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Uma Shakar on Israel-Palestine, A Threshold Crossed, and for Edward Said's book, Culture and Resistance, call us at 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Nader Hashemi and Sergio Atala. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with the Palestinian ensemble El Fanun performing Farda. Thank you.
You're listening.